what pride they had in Odessa came from their very survival in a place they openly admitted was physically wretched. Whether it was true or not, most people said they had first come out here during a sandstorm, meaning their first taste of Odessa had literally been a mouthful of gritty sand. They carried that mouthful with them forever, rolling it around with their tongues every now and then, never forgetting the dry grit of it. It reminded them of what they had been through to forge a life and a community, and that they had a right to be proud of their accomplishments. It was still a place that seemed on the edge of the frontier, a paradoxical mixture of the Old South and the Wild West, friendly to a fault, but fiercely independent, God-fearing and propped up by the Baptist beliefs in family and flag, but hell-raising, spiced with the edge of violence, but naive and thoroughly unpretentious. It was a place where neighbor loved helping neighbor, based on a long-standing tradition that ranchers always left their homes unlocked because you never knew who might need to borrow something or cook a meal. But it was a place also based on the principle that no one should ever be told what to do by anyone, that the best government of all was no government at all, which is why most citizens hated welfare, thought Michael Dukakis, beyond having the irreversible character flaw of being a Democrat, was the biggest damn fool ever to enter politics, considered Lyndon Johnson an egocentric buffoon responsible for the boondoggle of the 1964 Civil Rights Act, and saw the federal government's effort to integrate the Odessa schools in the 50s and 60s and 70s and 80s not as social progress, but as outrageous harassment. At times, Odessa had the feel of lingering sadness that many isolated places have, a sense of the world orbiting around it at dizzying speed while it stood stuck in time, 350 miles from Dallas to the east, 300 miles from El Paso to the west, 300 miles from the rest of the world, still fixed in an era in which it was inappropriate for high school girls to be smarter than their boyfriends, in which kids spent their Saturday nights making the endless circles of the drag in their cars along the wide swaths of 42nd Street and Andrews Highway, in which teenage honor was measured not by how much cocaine you snorted, but by how much beer you drank. But Odessa also evoked the kind of America that Ronald Reagan always seemed to have in mind during his presidency, a place still rooted in the sweet nostalgia of the 50s. Unsophisticated, basic, raw, a place where anybody could be somebody, a place still clinging to all the tenets of the American dream, however wobbly they had become. In the summer twilight, against the backdrop of the enormous sky where braids of orange and purple and red and blue, as delicately hued as a butterfly wing, stretched into eternity, young girls with ponytails and freckles went up and down neighborhood streets on their roller skates. As the cool breeze of night set in, neighboring families pulled up plastic lawn chairs to conduct chair committee and casually meander over the day's events without rancor or argument or constant one-upmanship. On other nights, parents gently roused their children from bed near the stroke of midnight so they could sit together by the garage to watch a thunderstorm roll in from Big Spring, gliding across the sky with its shimmering madness, those angular fingers of light cutting through the night in a spectacle almost as exciting as a Permian high school football game. There were many people in Odessa who, after the initial shock, had slowly fallen in love with the town. They found something endearing about it, something tender. It was the scorned mutt that no one else wanted. They had come to grips with the numbing vacantness of the surroundings, broken only by the black horses' heads of oil pump jacks moving up and down with maniacal monotony through heat and wind and dust and economic ruin. There were also those who had grown weary of it, and the oft-repeated phrase that what made it special was the quality of its people. "Odessa has an unspeakable ability to bullshit itself," said Warren Burnett, a loquacious, liberal-minded lawyer who, after roughly 30 years, had fled the place like a refugee for the coastal waters near Houston. "Nothing could be sillier than we got good people here. We got the same cross-section of assholes as anywhere." There were those who found it insufferably racist, and those who didn't find it racist at all, but used the word nigger as effortlessly as one would sprinkle salt on a slab of ribeye, and worried about the Mexicans, who seemed to be overtaking the place. There were those who had been made rich by it, and many more who had gone broke from it in recent times. But they seemed gratified, as Mayor Don Carter, who was one of those to go big-time belly up, put it, to have taken a chance in the free enterprise market. There were those who found its conservatism maddening and dangerous, and many more who found it the essence of what America should be, an America built on strength and the spirit of individualism, not an America built on handouts and food stamps. There were those who found solace in the strong doses of religion poured out every Wednesday evening and Sunday morning by its 62 Baptist churches, 19 Church of Christ churches, 12 Assembly of God churches, 11 Methodist churches, 7 Catholic churches, and 5 Pentecostal churches. And there were those like Burnett who saw religion in Odessa used not to reinforce religious beliefs at all, but as an excuse for people to come together and be made comfortable with their own social beliefs in racial and gender bigotry. Across the country, there were thousands of places just like it. Places that were not only isolated, but insulated. Places that had gone through the growing pains of America without anyone paying attention. Places that existed as islands unto themselves with no link to the great cities, except that they all sang the same national anthem to the same flag at sporting events. They were the kind of places that you saw from a plane on a clear night if you happened to look out the window, a concentration of little beaded dots breaking up the empty landscape, with several veins leading in and out, and then bleak emptiness once again. It was a view that every traveler had seen a million times before, and maybe if you were a passenger on a plane bisecting the night, you looked down and saw those lights and wondered what it would be like to live in an Odessa, to inhabit one of those infinitesimal dots, to be in a place that seemed so painfully far away from everything, so completely out of the mainstream of life. Perhaps you wondered what values people held on to in a place like that, what they cared about. Or perhaps you went back to your book, eager to get as far away as possible from that yawning maw that seemed so unimaginable, so utterly unimportant. In the absence of a shimmering skyline, the Odessas of the country had all found something similar in which to place their faith. In Indiana, it was the plink, plink, plink of a ball on a parquet floor. In Minnesota, it was the swoosh of skates on the ice. In Ohio and Pennsylvania and Alabama and Georgia and Texas and dozens of other states, it was the weekly event simply known as Friday Night. From the 20s through the 80s, whatever else there hadn't been in Odessa, there had always been high school football. In 1927, as story after story in the Odessa News heralded new strikes in the oil field, the only non-oil-related activity that made the front page was the exploits of the Odessa High Yellow Jackets. In 1946, when the population of Ector County was about 30,000, Old Fly Field was routinely crammed with 13,500 fans, many of whom saw nothing odd about waiting in line all night to get tickets. Odessa High won the state championship that year, which became one of those events that was remembered in the psyche of the town forever, as indelible as Neil Armstrong landing on the moon. Where were you the moment the Broncos won the championship? Everyone knew. In the 60s and 70s and 80s, when the legacy of high school football in Odessa transferred from Odessa High to Permian High, instead of just waiting all night for tickets, people sometimes waited 2 days. Gaines and the other Permian coaches were all too aware of the role that high school football occupied in Odessa, how it had become central to the psyche of thousands who lived there. Expectations were high every year, and in 1988, if it was possible, they were even higher than usual. The team had an incredible array of talent, the devout boosters whispered, the best of any Permian team in a decade. Winchell back at quarterback, Miles back at fullback, Chavez back at tight end, Brown back at flanker, Hill back at split end. They listed off the names as if they were talking about the star-studded cast of a movie spectacular, and they frankly didn't see how Permian could miss a trip to state this season. They weren't the only ones to think so. The Associated Press, making its predictions for the season, had picked Permian to win it all. Although Aldine, Sugarland, Willow Ridge, Hurst Bell, San Antonio Clark, and Houston Yates are gaining big support, the guess here is that there will be a big surprise from out west, the article said. Remember Odessa Permian? The Panthers and their legendary Mojo Magic always contend for the title. To the boosters, that story was music to their ears. Further confirmation that when the middle of December rolled around, they would be on their way to Texas Stadium for the state championship. To Gaines, it only created more room for anger and disappointment if the team didn't get there. When he spoke to the players that very first time, he told them to ignore the outside pressure that would inevitably swirl around them during the thick of the season. "I'm going to get criticism, and you're going to get criticism," he said. "It don't mean a hill of beans, because the only people that matter are in this room. It doesn't make a difference except for the people here." In the solitude of the fieldhouse on that beautiful August morning, it was hard to believe that anyone else did matter. But the feeling was only temporary. In just about a week, the team would be officially unveiled to the public, and from that moment on, it would become the property of those so desperately devoted to it. There were certain events in Odessa that had become time-honored traditions, essential elements in the biological clock of the town. There was the annual downtown Christmas tree lighting ceremony, sponsored by one of the banks, when people gathered on bleachers in front of the city hall and sipped free hot chocolate while waiting for Santa to arrive on a flatbed truck. There was the biennial oil show, which out-of-town hookers always marked on their calendars and read because of the tantalizing possibility of having thousands of out-of-towners stuck in Odessa for what might possibly be the three longest days of their lives. And, of course, in late August, there was the Permian Booster Club's watermelon feed, when excitement and madness went quickly into high gear. Chapter 2. The Watermelon Feed. The faithful sat on little stools of orange and blue under the merciless lights of the high school cafeteria, but the Spartan setting didn't bother them a bit. Had the watermelon feed been held inside the county jail or on a sinking ship or on the side of a craggy mountain, they would still have flocked to attend. Outside, the August night was sweetly cool and serene, with just a wisp of West Texas wind. Inside, there was a teeming sense of excitement and also relief, for the waiting was basically over. There would be no more sighs of longing, no more awkward groping to fill up the empty spaces of time with golf games and thoroughly unsatisfying talk about baseball. Tonight, as in a beauty contest, the boys of Permian would come before the crowd one by one so they could be checked out and introduced. And after that, In less than 2 weeks would come the glorious start of the season on the first Friday night in September. Each of those little stools in each of those rows, about 400 seats in all, was taken well before the scheduled starting time of 7:30. It didn't take long before the open area at the back of the room had filled up with several hundred other people who hardly minded standing as long as they were inside. Finally, it got so crowded that those who came didn't even bother to try to get in, but stayed in the hallway and watched with their faces pressed up against a long window, like out-of-luck shoppers peering into the bedlam of a once-in-a-lifetime sale. A concession stand in the corner did a brisk business in hats and T-shirts and jackets and flags. Another one sold decals and little good luck charms. And each devotee, as he or she walked in, carried a special program about as thick as a city phone book. Many had their kids with them, for it was clear they thought it was important for children to see this spectacle at a young age so they could begin to understand what it all meant. A little boy wore a T-shirt that said, "Hold on, Mojo, I'm a-comin'," and another had a towel and a flag emblazoned with the Mojo rallying cry. People had come dressed up for the event. They weren't in black tie or anything outlandish like that, but just in black. Black caps, black shirts, black pants, black jackets. Many others went a step further. They had black keychains and black checkbook covers. If you went to their homes, you might find black toilet seats or black seat cushions or black phone book covers or black paper plates or black clocks or black felt on their pool tables. To get to and from those homes, they might drive cars with brake lights in the back windows that lit up with the word Mojo every time they touched the pedals. And next to them in those cars might be handmade black purses in the shape of a football with the word Mojo inscribed on them in white, or the less lavish Mojo handbags sold exclusively at JCPenney. Our Permian Panther leather two-tone bag has an understated designer look, extolled the newspaper advertisement, which were regularly $24.99, but were sometimes on sale for $8.99. There were about 800 persons crammed into the Permian High School cafeteria by the time the watermelon feed began. Almost all of those in the crowd were white, and their faces had a certain flattened, non-frilled look, like the land in which they lived. The women tended to be more handsome than pretty, with high, articulated cheekbones. The men tended to be taut and well-built, regardless of age, dressed in beige or gray pants, the color of the plains, and cowboy boots that were worn for function. The starkness of the room seemed to heighten the natural warmth of the occasion. About the only items on the white walls were two announcements for Permian students on long strips of computer paper that had nothing to do with the watermelon feed, but still embodied the intrinsic spirit of the event. The one on top read, "You must have a student ID to be admitted to games with student tickets." The one underneath read, "You must have a student ID card to check out a library book." The fans clutched in their hands the 1988 Permian Football Yearbook, published annually by the Booster Club to help generate funds for the program. It ran 224 pages. Had 513 individual advertisements, and raised $20,000. Virtually every lawyer, doctor, insurance firm, car dealer, restaurant, and oil field supply business in town had taken out an ad, both as a show of support for Permian football and perhaps as a form of protection. The Ector County Sheriff had taken out an ad. So had the Ector County Democratic Party, just in case there were a few closet Democrats who, under conditions similar to those offered a mafia informant in the witness protection program, might be willing to divulge their political persuasion. The Grand Dukes of Permian, men in their 50s and 60s who had become as dependent on the Panthers as they were on their jobs and children and wives, and treated the memory of each game as a crystal prism that